It's spoiler in time. If you encountered this just randomly in the Cord Killers feed, you may be thinking, wait, thought this was a show about cutting the cords. It is not this show. Cord Killers is the show where we teach you that. This is the show where we enjoy the fruits of our labor and talk about all the stuff we watched, what we want, when we want, on whatever device we please. I'm Brian Brushwood. Joining me is our board operator and producer extraordinaire, Mr. Bryce Castillo. How are you, Bryce?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Yeah, we are down one Tom Merritt, who decided that he'd rather go to the other side of the planet than hang out with us.
They don't even use the same seasons that we do.
So they can't be bothered to have winter at the same time. Oh, man, it's probably nice and cool in Australia right now.
Probably.
Yeah.
Because it'll almost be summer there.
Meanwhile, we're going to talk about a bunch of different stuff, including episodes 202 and 203 of Legion. We're going to talk about the latest Westworld, episode 204. And the first two episodes of Cobra Kai, YouTube Red Original. That's right. But first, we're going to take a moment and check out the standings of
the Summer Movie Draft!
Nice.
I like it. I like the two of us in tandem. Synchronicity. Coming in at first place is a team nobody heard of. DTNS.
Now, what does that stand for?
Daily Tech News Show. Tom's team is crushing it now with $565 million and climbing, the third weekend in a row that Amazon Avengers Wars. Avengers Infinity War.
It'll be over in 2 days.
Avengers Infinity War is just continuing to crush it. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, his second movie, Tom's second movie, Breaking In, just released, which seems like it's doing very poorly.
$17 million is, a $5 buy.
For a $5 dollar buy, it's not bad. But critically, I think I saw it was like at 23% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Ew.
Wasn't doing really great. So I was thinking Avengers and two decent movies could give him the win. But if he's now, Avengers and a rounding error movie...
Now, there's also Hereditary, which could be good. It could be a good big horror movie.
Well, and keep in mind, Hereditary, that's the Keanu Reeves one, right?
No, this is it's a woman and her kid.
I'm thinking of Replicas. That's what it is.
That's later in the year.
Ah, man. So meanwhile, second place, Team Night Attack has $251 million, still way underperforming what we were hoping for. Meanwhile, I'm looking at Cord Killers. They've got Solo tracking huge. Mm-hmm. They've already got, because they got a Quiet Place, even though they didn't spend great money for it, they got a Quiet Place, which is already at $187 million.
Wow.
Life of the Party, I think, just came out, and it's not making crazy money either, only $17 million.
Again, another $5 buy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's still bad. Those are both...
But this
the
is just
two
it.
Two of
is
the worst.
They have Solo and Replicas, and Solo, if it does... 80% as well as Infinity Wars, they're gonna rock it to first place. It's this is a big deal. I think Solo's gonna do really, really well.
It'll be interesting. This is the first draft in a while where the big movies have been at the beginning.
Yeah,
Avengers is not even the 10th movie. Solo is coming out in just a few weeks, and we're not even in June yet. It'll be really interesting to see what happens with the rest of the lineup, because hopefully we're not set by the time Solo comes out and we know whose big movie is bigger. But I'd like to think that there are enough other wild cards left in the draft. Oceans,
once we
Incredibles,
get past Solo,
Jurassic World.
I guess we know Deadpool 2 is going to be huge. We know Solo is going to be huge. The wild cards are, I'm looking at Oceans 8. Yeah. I'm looking at Incredibles 2. Certainly Jurassic World on paper, you would think it would make really good money. And certainly I'm already seeing soda cans with tie-ins and all that stuff. But yeah. I am not feeling Jurassic World 2 fever from anybody. Everybody's still talking about
it's good selling, but that's your movie in the draft too.
Sorry. It's like I'm not going to be able to push things one way or the other.
I feel like even some of these smaller movies, like I think The First Purge could do well for what it was sold for $16, but I think that'll only do well relatively compared to other Purge movies, not really on the big blockbuster scape that we're playing today.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
We got a letter here in triage from There's no name on this, but it's about Ant-Man and the Wasp. We're also assuming...
Oh, yeah. So this is spoilers for Avengers.
For Avengers Infinity War.
Maybe scoot forward 5 minutes.
Yeah. Hey, guys, just a thought about the comments made regarding Ant-Man and the Wasp. It makes sense that both of these movies coming out next in the Marvel lineup, Captain Marvel included, would take place before the events of Infinity War. One, because it allows for those heroes to have stories that will not be hindered by the end of Avengers. And technically, if Avengers 4 is to take place right after, then that is what you want. Two, if you have these movies take place after, it would mean they would have to share the ending of Infinity War en masse with two separate production crews and casts. I imagine this would be an issue seeing as Avengers 3, when it's notorious for its secrecy. On a story note, having Ant-Man take place before also lends itself to explain his absence from Infinity War, and also allows for a post-credit scene with the Wasp and half the cast all turning into ash, or just disappearing once the finger snap happens. Although I will admit, it would be very interesting if a good chunk of time were to pass between Avengers movies, and you show the world as it is in between. Cheers.
Yeah, I agree. It would be interesting, but ultimately, for all the reasons that you mentioned, I think
it has to be before.
Right. It has to be before. And I like the fact that it's uniform, that both of them are before, where it's like, we're taking a break between this Avengers movie and this Avengers movie. It's all back catalog stories.
Also, and Captain Marvel takes place in the 90s. So that's not even setting it before Avengers. That is just
way before.
It's way before.
Right. Similar to, like a Captain America or whatever. It makes it a period piece. Although the Ant-Man and the Wasp thing, I guess that explains the house arrest thing, I assume, because I didn't remember that from anything. I just assumed that that was a reference to Ant-Man getting in trouble. Yeah. Now it makes me feel like that'll be how Ant-Man ends, is with some kind of compromise. He's under house arrest.
Yeah, that would make sense. I didn't see the first Ant-Man, so I just assumed, I don't know, he got lost.
Plus,
somewhere.
Also, they've already set up Ant-Man as a shady, you know, heist character. So, you know, whether I remembered it or not, I'm like, sounds like Ant-Man. You know, so it was fine.
Yeah, that all makes sense. It would. I think it's an interesting thought experiment of how you set.
Oh, this is interesting. Beatmaster points out that by setting at least maybe Captain Marvel in the past, we get Agent Phil Coulson.
That's right. I think they've confirmed that.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
I thought he was coming back. I thought they were reviving him for Avengers 3.
I mean,
Infinity War. But
yeah,
I guess that didn't happen. I feel like I just heard that somewhere. They're like, Coulson's coming back.
But they already brought him back for the TV show, right? Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, or at least some clone of him or something. Because
I'm not going to watch a TV show.
I don't watch a TV show. Meanwhile, what do you want to move on to?
Let's talk about Cobra Kai.
Okay.
All right, tell me. So I have not seen The Karate Kid.
Just give everybody, take a moment.
Take a moment.
Let everybody
what you need to say.
Stop gasping. For those of you who are driving, I'm sorry that you weren't warned ahead of time.
But
oh, laws. My lord.
Oh, Jesus Christ. But I liked a lot about Cobra Kai. It set up everything I needed to know from the stuff I didn't already know.
In the first, 2 minutes.
Yeah. With, hey, here is the big match. That's what you needed to know. And I like the idea of showing a continuation of this. Oh, the guy who got his comeuppance, here's what happens to him now. Not doing so hot. Meanwhile, you know, the good guy in the movie's he's doing great. He's got a premium car dealership and a kid or two and a wife, and things are hunky-dory, ?
Right.
And it does a very good job of making you relate and feel empathetic for Johnny. Is that right?
Yeah. Johnny Lawrence was maybe one of the best, most hateable bad guys in 1980s movies, because he did not only this movie, The Karate Kid, but he also was the bad guy in Just One of the Boys.
Yeah.
But he has that delightfully punchable face at that age, and he's got those stereotypical Hollywood good looks that made you, and he was always represented as somebody of privilege, which I think is one of my favorite things about Cobra Kai, is that you never saw the depth of his reality. And in Cobra Kai, they make it very clear his he came from a breaking home at the time, which is why he found solace in punching other people and acting like a bully, is because he felt powerless in the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. And what seemed at the time to be the trappings of success and privilege, in fact, become this chain around his neck, and that he's still driving around that 1984 Pontiac or whatever.
Yeah.
It did the impossible, which is make Johnny a relatable schlub protagonist, and knowing that, even knowing exactly what they were doing from the moment they did it, having that dawning realization of like, oh my God, I think they're gonna make the worst bad guy in all of 80s movies like the our protagonist. This is the person with an arc.
Yeah.
And they just keep punching Wendy's down, and they do the ballsiest thing. They have him not only get into a car drunk, but drinking while driving. While driving. And I think to myself, well, I know the rules of filmmaking, and there's no way he gets out of this consequence free. And then he just shows up at the place like, well, that worked out fine.
and then like, his car does crash, and he's not even in it.
It's not his fault. And then the moment the car crashes, they say like, I told you not to be using a cell phone while driving. And so, which I love that moment, because they took a 1980s boogeyman with driving and replaced it with a 21st century boogeyman of driving, right?
Some might say you can do both of those in the same, but
correct. Yeah. Right. But my point is, for the same reason I loved The Last Jedi, I loved how often they went out of their way to subvert your expectations. You know, the main character of Daniel LaRusso in The Karate Kid was so adorably undervalued, like you were on his side, you know. He was getting kicked around, he was in a place he didn't know or understand, and it was just so painful. And to feel myself just want to punch him in his smug everything's fine face, where the whole power dynamic has shifted, right? Yeah.
So I watched the second episode also, which focused more on Daniel's life,
yes,
basically,
which starts off with the stereotype that all Johnny sees is him having all the money and all the success, and all he wants to do is punch his face. Mm-hmm. But then they open up the complications that come from losing, you know, connection with your kids,
right? And his kid wants to be the popular kid, which means being mean and creating their own underdogs.
By the way, did you notice that his other kid, the son, was the kid who played, I'm almost certain of this, I could be wrong, and if I'm wrong, somebody will correct me, but yeah. I'm pretty sure it's the kid who played young Jack Black in the Tenacious D movie.
Oh, really?
Oh, the dragon's balls are blazing as I stepped into a cave.
That's funny.
I slashed his mighty cackles with my long and shiny blade.
So the thing that kind of struck me about Daniel's character was it was kind of a shame. There's that really great confrontation in either the end of episode one or the middle of episode two, where Daniel shows up at Johnny's dojo and they have that big, you know,
like, what are you doing? Yeah.
And it was frustrating because it felt like Daniel, he felt, if we're saying that Johnny is very realistic feeling, Daniel felt like an unrealistic parent in a movie of, like, you know, he only heard the part of the story and thinks it's the bad guy, when it's like, if these two were being realistic, ideally he would say, well, no, your kid was doing this, this guy was doing this, I'm trying to be the good guy, and he would be able to see it, instead of like being this thing of like, Cobra Kai's the devil, they're back in town.
But that's also the adorably simplistic and ignorant view that you would expect somebody who comes in as a doughy-eyed kid in the Karate Kid. And you know what might be interesting is, if you're enjoying this enough to keep going, it would be really interesting for you to watch Cobra Kai and then watch the Karate Kid.
Yeah.
Or maybe even just this far in, watch the Karate Kid, because he is adorably pure in the Karate Kid, which is what makes us engage and fall in love with him. Mm. Like, he unflinchingly just does what Mr. Miyagi says. And at some point, you know, he just feels things so intently, and he knows what's right. And it's that strong moral compass that makes him our hero. And you would expect that carried forward with the force of inertia would yield somebody who, you know, is a good dad and a good businessman and, you know, maybe a little bit simple. You know, he's giving away bonsai trees and doing kicks or whatever.
Chops, yeah.
Which, by the way, you feel how, while it's clearly meant sincerely from the person, Daniel LaRusso, you see it through Johnny's eyes and it looks so insincere, like a cheesy gimmick.
Oh, yeah.
Which, when you see if you had seen The Karate Kid, both the bonsai tree and, you know, his journey with karate are so heavy duty that they're so sincere that to see them even portrayed or seen as gimmicky and insincere is almost painful. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, I might watch, because I it was the sort of thing with The Force Awakens, not to spoil that movie, but I went into The Force Awakens not having seen much
when
of
Mr.
Star
Miyagi
Wars.
Showed up.
And I could tell that there was a lot of, okay, there are a lot of like big Star Wars moments in this franchise. And I felt enough of that in the first two episodes that I was like, okay, there's a lot of stuff that is for people who know the movies, obviously, because it's not being created in a vacuum.
Right.
So I don't know whether I would go and watch the movie now or at the end, because I would like to think it would get over those humps pretty early on, which is something I think happened in Last Jedi. And that, anyway, that's a Star Wars talk. So you've seen the two episodes after this.
Yeah. So let me spoil for you kind of where stuff heads by episode four. I'm only seen up to episode four.
Okay.
Episode three and four were behind the paywall. Spoiler alert. I went ahead and bought YouTube Red because we were having so much fun with it. Again, specifically them constantly subverting expectations. One of the most surprising things is almost, or I'm not going to say that this is their message, but I unironically wanted this classy, savvy millennial kid to learn to punch someone in the face. Like you, when you see everything that, I forget the name of the kid, goes through and, you have a moment that you find out that, that the guy who beat him up is dating Daniel LaRusso's daughter. You know, that Daniel LaRusso's daughter was the one that crashed into Johnny's car and stuff. And you also see reflections of what bullying looks like in the 21st century, where they do cyberbullying stuff and it's not heavy handed. Like it really stings. It's really, there's kind of back and forth and you see, Daniel LaRusso's daughter sort of, dealing with the fact that she's got this, smart friend that she's leaving, that she's distancing herself from, but also trying to hold on to while they go. And there's some great...
Go for it. I'm going to say we made a new time code for up to episode four. Just tell me a little bit.
Sure. Well, the bullies are really nasty and you want to see them beat up. You also see that they're so two-faced, which again is a very... That's a level of sophistication you didn't get in early 80s, morality tales like this one. Like the bad guys were bad. They were jerks all the time. And the good guys were, you know, honest in feeling or whatever. Whereas this is just riddled with nuance. We see Johnny at his worst. He's still very much an alcoholic and is not getting his act together. Yeah. We meet his ex-wife. We meet his estranged son that wants to have nothing to do with him.
Yeah.
And likewise, we see that Daniel LaRusso is far from perfect. He's been absent and, you know, he can't look at his daughter as the 16-year-old that she is. He only sees her as the 8-year-old little karate champ that he was training not so long ago. There is a great moment when they're at the movie theater and douchebag boyfriend starts putting the moves on her and she just goes, like just casually uses the karate to rebuff his advances. There's also great moments that would not have happened back in the 1980s. And again, there's no way to not see this through that lens, but, the grandma of, the young kid, he is learning to work out and punch and fight. And so he's in his bedroom and you hear the grunting, the And so the mom knocks on the door and is just like, hey, dinner. And he's just like, I'm almost done, Dan. And she rolls her eyes and makes a rude gesture of what she thinks he's up to. Yeah. And I thought, like, what an amazing difference of you know, 30, 35 years of.
See, that feels like an 80s or 90s. Movie thing. Maybe she wouldn't do a J.O.
Sure. But also, yeah, like the immediate, the fact that nowadays most kids are growing up in a world, absence of violence as a way to solve problems. Yeah. And it's almost as though part of the underlying message, which I'm really interested to see if they stick the landing, is it almost feels like it's a rejection of the idea that violence doesn't solve anything. And it's like, looking at it, you're like, yeah, violence does a pretty good job of stopping someone from thinking you're an easy target for violence, you know, and mm-hmm. and whether that's right or wrong, it certainly is what my gut is telling me. Yeah. And that is very novel in a sophisticated, savvy 21st century show.
In the episodes that I watched, I really walked away not knowing what the show would end up trying to tell, what the moral of the story would try to be, because you kind of get, I watched the preview at the end of the second episode. It's like, hey, what's the next come? And it's like, it's Johnny and his dojo, and he's got more kids, and he's training even more people. But it's still got this sinister tone. So it's like,
But the people he's training are the disenfranchised, are the bullied. They're the weak. And now he's the weak teaching the weak, and he's saying you don't have to be weak, which is fascinating. This is what I wanted out of, you know, seeing the exploration of the dark side of the Force in a Star Wars story. Like, it feels good to be bad. Like yeah, I want all of this is Revenge of the Nerds stuff, you know, where it's like, I don't know. There's also some great moments. There's some good writing. There's one kid who has a fairly pronounced hair lip surgery, you know, and yeah, there's a woman, the guidance counselor has everybody's attention. She's like, now I will not name names, but one student's mother called me saying her child was crying because somebody had made fun of his facial deformity. And it's just those delightful, painful moments. You're like, oh, this is awful.
Yeah.
It's fun. I'm really enjoying it. It's great.
Very cool. I'm sure I'll probably, I think I'll probably finish it at some point. I'd like to know where it goes, because I think it is, at least early on, complicated.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see where it lands on all of that stuff, because I think the use of violence is very specific. The introduction of cyberbullying, all that stuff. But I had to roll my eyes in the second episode, or even the first episode, where it's like, no, it was the second, where it's like, oh yeah, these kids and their tablets and the millennials with their food allergies and city code inspectors trying to get in my way.
To put it in perspective, Bonnie cackled at the rolling of eyes of it, and your peanut allergies and none of that exists in here.
Right. You don't have asthma anymore. He throws his inhaler. Like, you can't do that.
I loved all of it. I loved it.
And so I don't know whether it's trying to be a parody with that.
Do you want to try? You know what? Maybe it would be better to just try, if you don't mind the homework assignment of just watching The Karate Kid.
Yeah, maybe we'll watch a few more episodes and come back to it next week.
Okay.
I bet you're going to watch more of it.
Oh yeah, I'll watch all. I'll probably watch all of it. Yeah.
So stay tuned next week for our thoughts on Cobra Kai. Let's talk about Legion.
Oh, Legion. Okay.
Episode 202 and 203.
Okay. Here's a fun game.
Okay.
Called Two Adult Men Who within the last 48 hours have watched two episodes of Legion, try to interpret and or remember what the heck happened.
So I remember a lot of this, so I can recap at least some of this, right?
Okay,
so 202, what's his name? The main character. This is not a good sign.
David.
David. Is talking with
Oliver
and
Lenny on the carousel.
On the carousel. And he's saying, hey, I'm going to work with you. I'm going to be a double agent.
And then also, so at the end of the first episode, the big surprise is that future Sid shows up with one arm and says, hey, that guy that you're trying to hunt down and get, you got to help him. And he's like, why? She's like, shut up. I'm from the future, Sid. And he's like, okay. And so he finds Oliver, who is housing the soul of somebody named Farouk, who's the name of the yellow-eyed
Shadow
man,
King.
The Shadow King, right? Yeah.
And Lenny, a persona.
Right, but strangely, they're all not the same, and they're all in his head, and at some point, David said, I don't understand what's happening, and Lenny's just like, don't worry about it.
That's how they start off the second episode, too, where where Oliver's just like, you don't ask a mealworm what it thinks. What? Tell me what's going on!
So, he leads...
He believes that he is leading everyone to the right place to find Farouk.
Oliver, because Farouk is inhabiting Oliver's body, right?
Right.
And also, I guess, later we find out is also imprisoning the soul of Lenny, who I guess was a real person and not a figment of his imagination.
Right.
But she can't get out because her body is dead, even though she didn't have a body because she was a figment of imagination. I guess he manufactured a body for her and killed her accidentally.
Well, she was a real, like... junkie.
No, her, that was
that not th- even
there
real?
Was like Benny, or remember it turned out to be a guy. There was no Lenny.
That's
right?
Right,
so not only I guess, are you okay? Like, we're only getting started. Wait. Sir.
Okay, so he says they're gonna do the whole forces go out to the desert field thing, and oh, there's nothing here, and they come back and oops, Farouk came, and I don't remember why he attacked the facility, because it's
Because he's bad.
It seemed like all he did was cause Bonnie and Clyde. What are their names? They have the same name. The doctor and the Kung Fu girl.
Yes.
He caused
doctor
them to,
and cool girl.
Yeah. He caused them to split and inverse, basically.
Yes. Although it was kind of adorable, and I think we're getting into season or episode 3 territory, having him awkwardly explain to her all the biological processes that she does not have to deal with because she very rarely sticks around long enough to need to
use the restroom.
Exactly.
Or anything. Yeah.
That was adorably awkward. But then they, I guess, and forgive me if this is not the motivation behind it, but it really felt like they're all like, what's a way we can not have to pay for Jemaine Clement for every episode? How about we just have Farouk, unfamiliar actor, show up?
I liked seeing Farouk's image. He has kind of a powerful persona, and the idea like, oh, this is the mystery evil man from 1,000 years ago.
Yes.
He wears it very well.
But yeah, and also it's very well acted, and he wears this sophistication that seems to come from like a 1960s era Mediterranean vibe, you know. Let's talk about the fight scene that starts off as wrestling. And Farouk is like, this is how you say homoerotic. And then it's like, aha, but we're not wrestling. We're fencing.
That's right. Naga, knife.
Also, psych. It's the 100-meter hurdles.
Yeah. It was a lot like the dance battle in the first episode. If you remember that, which is more psychic showboating.
I don't mind there being a metaphor, but at some point it got awfully mixed up metaphor. It started to feel mushy, and I lost a little bit.
And then at the end of episode 2, we have David talking to Girly. What's her name?
Lenny.
His girlfriend.
Sid.
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 Saying, hey,
okay,
the future you told me not to tell you, but I think for some reason that means I get to tell you.
Yeah, okay. And then, okay.
I have to team up with the bad guys because Sid says,
how come you're doing the opposite of helping us like you promised to?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, because future you told me to. And she's like, okay, I guess that's good enough for me. And then also we still have Baskethead and mustachioed Gladys's.
Sure.
None of whom really appear to be adding much to anything to my mind.
I feel like those four characters are extensions of the same character.
Yes.
Like clearly they're speaking for the basket-headed character.
Correct.
But I don't, I don't
say it.
Dan Wally in the chat said that possibly the reason that Lenny attacked the base while they were gone was to get a weapon or a machine to help bring Lenny back or to do some MacGuffin thing. But then there's also an attack in the third episode on the base, which is how we get the really cool, you know, oh, everyone's in the maze in their head and we get to go in and uncover their maze. And so,
oh yeah, no, that was nice. I liked the Ptolemy gardening. And each one had their own sets of fears.
Yeah.
What was it? Ptolemy, mm-hmm. lost his mind. It was just in the garden in his happy place. Right. Yeah. Had to be brought out. I don't know.
The older
Archer's
woman.
Mom.
Yeah. She was in like a choose your own adventure story.
Yeah. Which I thought was a cool thing. I didn't think it was quite executed to the budgetary level I would have liked to have seen, but I think it was fine thematically.
Yeah. And so I hope I like that idea to give us new spaces, because right now we're a little claustrophobic.
Yeah.
But I want to know something is going to keep happening instead of just like,
I'll tell you this much.
Attacks.
3 episodes into the second season, mm-hmm. I've seen some gorgeous cinematography, some really interesting vignettes. I bet it was a fantastic writer's room meeting. Ultimately, the fact that they keep, I don't mind them taking me to crazy places. I mind them kicking out the blocks of wood I've been standing on underneath me and saying, forget about those. Those don't count. And I'm like, I don't believe any of you anymore. And that's very challenging for me.
And it's tough because I think it's being obtuse. I think it's being intentionally obtuse in a lot of ways. Like, I like the moments, these, you know, the John Hamm narrated moments.
I
about
always
reality.
Hate the first 30 seconds of those. And then I get into the groove and I'm like, this is pretty great.
Yeah.
I like these.
And, you know, okay, so there are ideas, and ideas can also be dangerous. And what is reality? And what is reality in terms of related to humanity? But I don't know. I don't, it's not meshing with the narrative of the story quite yet.
It's,
and maybe it will. We're still very early in the season, but ooh boy, howdy.
It's, and they are really good. I guess this is the part that I didn't realize watching it, because I was so tied up in mm-hmm. my frustration of the progression that I didn't notice until we've talked it through just now, how delightful each of those individual vignettes are. Each one is very well executed. It's well acted, in self-contained. Each one makes me think like, well, I want to see all of these, right? Mm-hmm. But the fact that theoretically they're supposed to line up and tell a story, that is not happening.
We're not there yet.
Yeah.
But I also think we have that same issue with Westworld, especially now where Westworld's not exactly telling a linear story.
Well, hold on. Let's save that for Westworld.
But what I'm saying, what I'm trying to get at is that it's not trying to please us now. It's trying to please us at a much later date, which is high risk, high reward.
And it might be that they land it so hard that I'm like, all is forgiven. Thank you for giving me all those pieces of backstory, which I'm almost feeling for Westworld as we move into Westworld. You want to talk about Westworld?
Well, let's talk about the end of Legion 203 real quick, where they find the monk. The monk who supposedly knows where Farouk's body is.
And he just jumps off a building.
And he jumps off the building.
To no consequence or seeming advancement of anything.
And I mean, he...
And they're like, by the way, everyone's teeth chatter because I'm so awesome, everyone wants to be like me.
Is that what that was?
Yeah, remember they said he sung a seductive song or a very catchy tune. That's the way he put it. Like, basically, just psychically, he puts out the vibes that his affliction of chattering his teeth... by virtue of just, you know, osmosis, other people got caught up in the loop of doing.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I don't know. We'll see. I think maybe we'll watch a little bit more before next week.
Yeah.
For
I'm more into it now than I was after that first episode.
Yeah, for sure. This sounded like a very negative segment of Spoiler Time, but we still really enjoy the show.
Yeah. Keep in mind, we hold the first season of Legion in the highest of regard. So I hold it in the highest regard.
Okay. Let's talk about Westworld 204. This happened. This is the recent episode from this week.
Did you get a chance to give it a review? Because
so,
you watched it late at night when you were drifting off.
I kept
watched it
asleep.
First thing in the morning and gave it my full attention.
I watched most of it again today with my full faculties, and I liked it a lot better. I also found out like 5 or 10 minutes I totally just missed completely because I didn't rewind back enough.
Giant chunks of it.
I like that they're giving us more about each character. You know, they're finally giving William any weight.
Yes.
You know, and they're showing us more of the ruthlessness of Dolores. We're seeing. I had trouble. The one thing I had trouble with this episode was following William's daughter. In my initial watch, I did not realize that that she was the woman in the Indian world.
Yes,
and that she was the woman who washed up on shore and captured by the Native American tribe, and is also the same person at the end of this episode.
Yes,
who meets up with the Man in Black. Yeah, none of that connected with me. I was like, why do I care about this woman?
I didn't have as hard a time. I made the mistake because that last scene, she's backlit by the sun or whatever. And uh-huh. The last thing we saw was it Ellie leaving Bernard. Uh-huh. And so I'm like, wait, is Ellie his daughter? But then, you know, it took me a second to, as far as I know, that would make a lot more sense that she left India, was familiar with all the games, that she would learn the background stuff like the Lakota. I loved the fact... before we dive in,
okay.
At this point, more than at any point in all of Westworld, I feel like I actually understand the broad swaths of what characters' motivations are and what the rules are to interpret them. I loved, capital L-O-V-E-D, the fact that they flat out said, granted, they used the ridiculous trope of, oh, you need thinking juice? Let me just squeeze thinking juice. No, you're good. You got thinking fluid.
Yeah.
But I did like the fact that Bernard flat out says, man, something's messed up with my memories. I can't tell if what's happening right now or if I'm remembering from the past. And it's like, all I heard was viewers at home, anytime Bernard is on screen, it could be any timeline starting now.
Yeah.
I'm like, great. That's very helpful. Thank you.
That was just so frustrating. It was just frustrating, though.
It was frustrating in this episode or previous to this?
It's been frustrating this season to try to keep that alongside everyone else's very linear story.
By the way, William's daughter is Grace.
Okay, great.
Other things. Okay. Because remember last week I said I was frustrated because I knew so few of the characters' motivations. So I started thinking of our main players as we went through it. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that certainly at this point, I think this episode made a lot of headway on very clearly delineating what success conditions were for different people. Mm-hmm. Yes, Maeve is still a cartoon. I want my daughter, whatever that means.
Maeve in this episode, by the way.
You know what? I was okay with that. Maeve is frustrating to me because she acts with a lot of passion and direction and yet without justification for either.
Okay.
Bernard, I finally got total clarity as to what he's up to. Mm-hmm. He says he knows he's done some stuff. Memories are very flawed.
Yeah.
But now they also flatly said, ever since Ford died, we now know for a fact that everything from here forward, Bernard has autonomy.
Mm-hmm. But after the game started, he was directly under Ford's control in some manner.
Correct. But after Ford died, they seem to indicate that he has autonomy at this point.
At this point, he does. Yeah.
Yes. Correct.
But he seems to think that whatever he did to all the hosts in the ocean.
That's right. Yeah.
Because that's what he told Ellie, is that when he was dragging her into that cave, apparently he was not in his own mind.
Also, a little bit frustrating. Like, they definitely indicated to us that Ellie was killed by Bernard in season one. And then they walk in and there she is. And she goes, what's going on? You choked me out until I was unconscious. And then I wake up with a bunch of food locked in this cave and this shackle on my foot. I can't believe you, Bernard, the character, would do that to me, explaining my absence from the last several episodes.
It's weird. But they quote unquote killed her off at the end of season one without a lot of fanfare.
Right.
It was very much just
a soft sell.
Yeah.
She's like, she's sure, she's dead.
We'll deal with you next time.
Yeah.
But it was, they made a good duo, Ellie and Bernard.
Yeah. Well, and I like them coming to be on the same page. Other characters. Oh,
Delos.
I like before we get to Delos, that's the star of this episode. And all those vignettes I think were fantastic. Yeah. But the Lakota as players outside of the game. So all the hosts have gone from NPCs, non-player characters, to player characters. They have autonomy and they have a goal and they have a direction.
Yeah.
And they have different words for it. Like one of them says, we're riding on to glory or whatever. But the Lakota, as Grace figures out, Lakota aren't killing anyone. So maybe the Lakota are still NPCs to some degree, but with a different role. Like, they don't have autonomy. They're not playing for the game. They're still playing for the game within the game, maybe.
I could see that, because we also know that Constance is not her name. The
Clementine.
Clementine.
Yeah.
Is probably still acting under Ford's orders. She's dragging Bernard into the cave at the very beginning of the episode. So there's a chance that they are, as an entity, motivated to save the humans and kill
the
hosts.
You know what? Maybe all the hosts are still NPCs, but just for the better game.
Possibly.
Maybe they don't have autonomy.
I mean, that is a lot of Dolores' story of, like, trying to play the game to convince these different entities to side with her. That was with the Confederales last episode of, like, I need your army, and I won't just tell you we're fighting the humans. They're coming, and they got the alien guns, and it's very like kayfabe in a way that it doesn't need to be.
Yeah,
because they're probably not through that resistance barrier that Maeve and she seem to be under.
So
past.
That leaves two different themes. One, I was not a fan of the heavy-handed nitroglycerin beats. Like, they like that was pretty heavy-handed and a bit, it was just heavy across the board, right? So mm-hmm. but that's fine. It was classic Westworld. Mm-hmm. Subverting classic Westworld, what I loved from beginning to end were all the vignettes with Delos I loved that it was self-contained. From beginning to end, I feel like I got all the bits that I needed. It was very satisfying. There was a revelatory twist, and I felt like we saw the whole evolution of what happened with all of that.
Yeah.
That really made me happy.
And that really cemented, and I personally got this through reading some recaps this morning, but that really cemented, like, what the stakes of this game can be.
Yes. Well, the idea, like this IP sounded like corporate espionage all
right.
up until this.
We need some code. I don't know.
But the fact that they said, well, like, oh my God, could you imagine, like, when they asked, why are they collecting DNA and memories from everybody? And it's like, oh, blackmail, you know, like people do some horrific stuff in Westworld. But now it's like, now that they've introduced the idea of creating replicants, like full on replicants, we're in the Blade Runner territory. Like, now the idea that they could just manufacture, think about it, all the richest, most wealthy, most powerful people on the planet go to this place to get their DNA and minds downloaded. Right? The stakes are a bit higher now when you think about it that way.
I never put two and two together here, but yeah, what if
that's
these
the
various
IP.
Worlds? Yeah, what if these various worlds are not people going to play, or maybe they're playing while they're doing it, but people are going to, like, get profiled and then get written into these games.
Oh, that's
eternally.
Amazing. So it's like they're selling immortality,
yeah.
Where it's like, hey, you're rich, you're powerful. Here's what you do. You spend 6 weeks robbing, killing, shooting, and having sex with anything that moves with no mm-hmm. consequences whatsoever. We're going to use all of that to figure out what your darkest things are, what the borders of your personality are. And then when you die, we'll have another of you ready to go.
Right. We'll write you into the new story or, you know, yeah. That's interesting. That endeared me to the game. Oh, it's his game. Everybody watch out for the game. Oh, it's the game.
No, I will say this might be this. I don't think this episode was necessarily better than the second to last of the first season.
Okay.
But certainly I think it was as satisfying, maybe more satisfying, because so much more of the context is becoming apparent. They're not being as coy or as frustrating or as slow moving as they have been in the past.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Lon Makes points out in the chat, that's what this place does, reveals your true self. That, as he says, kind of on the nose.
Yeah. Yeah. Though I guess I wonder what happens to that game, right? If that's the state, let's just say that's the stated purpose of Westworld, is to create or to profile people and get some copyable data point.
Establish a baseline, would you say?
For fidelity.
Yeah.
In this scenario where it seems like all of the worlds have gone off the rails.
Or are going off the rails. But it seems like... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
It seems like they never reached the zenith of perfecting this, right? Even on that last attempt of Delos's clone thing, you know, his 150th or whatever, it still seemed like he was not quite there. Right there saying like, oh, well, there's a 30-day plateau where you guys just start to break down and we can't do nothing about you.
Well, and at the time of that recording when that happened, right? And maybe it's that...
So that was old William.
Yes, older William, but and also it's implied that it's very close to the quote-unquote current timeline, but maybe their whole thing is like the cryogenic frozen heads thing, where it's like, we don't have the technology, but let us collect all the data, collect all your DNA, establish the baseline so that we can make it. We'll get there. Don't worry about it. It's us.
Yeah.
So I could see something like that.
I'm digging this. I wanted a little more action in this episode because we had a lot of it in the past two.
I thought that was a pretty good badass set piece when William murdered everyone, and I'll tell you what.
Oh yes, in the control for Bernard.
I did not expect that because it was in a whiskey glass, and but knowing that it was nitroglycerin.
Oh yeah.
Just seeing that him force it down his throat, like I was picturing drinking that like whiskey, and I retched, like I gagged, like sitting alone in the room. I was like, like that was such an awful thought.
I think I forgot about that moment, even though I remember the big explosion moment at the end of that vignette. I think that's the weakest subplot for me right now, is like following William's cohort and trying to play that game for some reason.
We don't understand. I can feel Bernard's confusion. I can feel Maeve's desire to protect. I can feel Dolores's anger. I don't feel William's curiosity, like as a driving force. It doesn't resonate as much as I would like.
And I think that's a fundamental disconnect with the viewer, because William is an encyclopedia of this place. He knows all the characters. He knows how they work. And he's a great a sharpshooter, and he can survive. Where we're constantly being thrown in the deep end of Westworld and are often without, you know, the right flags to understand this stuff. So that one bit didn't. It was in that while only watching it. It's tough.
Well, let me put it this way: just as we are sort of giving a pass to these early second season episodes of Legion because we enjoyed the first season so much.
Yeah.
I feel like at this point, maybe we're being unnecessarily harsh on the first three or four episodes of Westworld of the second season because we were so frustrated with the first.
No, I think that is incredibly likely to be the case.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining us for Spoiler in Time. Don't forget that you can get Spoiler in Time early if you go to patreon.com/cordkillers. That's the name of the show. And if you're a patron, you get not only your own RSS feed with early access to stuff, but you'll get After Talk, where we just chat directly with you guys.
Yeah. Thank you guys for Spoiler in Time. A good Spoiler in Time was had by all. We'll see you guys next week.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.